everyone. Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, blessed Master, dearest Mother, saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king, reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Amen. It's wonderful to be here this morning. Read from the autobiography of a yogi. This is Master Mahasya speaking. Let us go tomorrow to Dakshineshwar Temple, forever hallowed by my guru. Master Mahasya was a disciple of a Christ-like master, Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa. The four-mile journey on the following morning was taken by boat on the Ganges. We entered the nine-domed temple of Kali, where the figures of the Divine Mother and Shiva rest on a burnished silver lotus, its thousand petals meticulously chiseled. Master Mahasya beamed in enchantment. He was engaged in an inexhaustible romance with the Beloved. As he chanted her name, my enraptured heart seemed shattered into a thousand pieces. We strolled later through the sacred precincts, halting in a tamarisk grove. The mana characteristic exuded by this tree was symbolic of the heavenly food Master Mahasya was bestowing. His divine invocations continued as I sat rigidly motionless on the grass amid the pink feathery tamarisk flowers. Temporarily absent from the body, I soared into supernal visit. This was the first of many pilgrimages to Dakshineshwar with the Holy Teacher. From him I learned the sweetness of God in the aspect of Mother, or Divine Mercy. The childlike saint found little appeal in the Father aspect, or Divine Justice. Stern, exacting, mathematical judgment was alien to his gentle nature. He can serve as an earthly prototype for the very angels of heaven, I thought fondly, watching him one day at his prayers. Without a breath of censure or criticism, he surveyed the world with eyes long familiar with the primal purity. His body, mind, speech, and actions were effortlessly harmonized with his soul simplicity. My master told me so. Shrinking from any personal assertion, the saint ended any sage counsel with this invariable tribute. So deep was his identity with Sri Ramakrishna that Master Mahasya was no longer considered his own thoughts as his own. Hand in hand, the saint and I walked one evening on the block of his school. My joy was dimmed by the arrival of a conceited acquaintance who burdened us with a lengthy discourse. I see, this man doesn't please you, the saint's whisper to me was unheard by the egotist, spellbound by his own monologue. I have spoken to the Divine Mother about it. She realizes our predicament. As soon as we get to yonder red house, She has promised to remind him of more urgent business. My eyes were glued to the sight of salvation. Reaching the red gate, the man unaccountably turned and departed, rather neither finishing his sentence nor saying goodbye. The assaulted air was comforted with peace. Another day found me walking near the Harwa railroad station. I stood for a moment by a temple, silently criticizing a small group of men with drum and cymbals who were violently reciting a chant. How undevotionally they used the Lord's name as in mechanical repetition, I reflected. My gaze was astonished by the rapid approach of Master Mahasya. Sir, how come you here? The saint, ignoring my question, answered my thought. Isn't it true, little sir, that the beloved's name sounds sweet from all lips, ignorant or wise? He passed his arms around me affectionately. I found myself carried on his magic carpet of merciful presence. Would you like to see some bioscopes? The question one afternoon from Master Mahasya was mystifying. The term was then used in India to signify motion pictures. I agreed, glad to be in his company in any circumstance. A brisk walk brought us to the garden, fronting Calcutta University. My companion indicated a bench near the Goldagi or pond. Let us sit here for a few minutes. My master always asked me to meditate whenever I saw an expanse of water. Here its placidity reminds us of the vast calmness of God. As all things can be reflected in water, so the whole universe is mirrored in the lake of the cosmic mind. So my Gurudev often said. Soon we entered a university hall where a lecture was in progress. It proved abysmally dull, though varied occasionally with lantern-like illustrations, equally uninteresting. So this is the kind of bioscope the master wanted me to see? My thought was impatient, yet I would not hurt the saint by revealing boredom in my face. But he leaned toward me confidently, confidentiality. I see, little sir, that you don't like this bioscope. I have mentioned it to the Divine Mother. She is in full sympathy with us both. She tells me that the electric lights will now go out and won't be relit until we have a chance to leave the room. As his whisper entered, the hall was plunged into darkness. The professor's strident voice was stilled in astonishment, then remarked, "The electrical system of this hall appears to be defective." By this time, Master Mahasya and I were safely across the threshold. Glancing back from the corridor, I saw the scene of our martyrdom had again become illumined. "Little sir, you were disappointed in that bioscope, but I think you will like a different one." The saint and I were standing on the sidewalk in front of the university building. He gently slapped my chest over the heart. A transforming silence ensued. Just as modern talkies become inaudible motion pictures when the sound apparatus goes out of order, so the divine hand, by some strange miracle, stilled the earthly bustle. The pedestrians, as well as the passing trolley cars, automobiles, bullock carts, and iron-wheeled hackney carriages, were all in noiseless transit. As though possessing an omnipresent eye, I beheld the scenes which were behind me, and to each side as easily as those in front. The whole spectacle of activity in the small section of Calcutta passed before me without a sound. Like a glow of fire dimly seen beneath a thin coat of ashes, a mellow luminous permeated the panoramic view. My own body seemed nothing more than one of many shadows, though it was motionless while the others flitted mutely to and fro. Several boys, friends of mine, approached and passed on, though they had looked directly at me, it was without recognition. The unique pantomime brought me an inexpressible ecstasy. I drank deep from some blissful fount. Suddenly my chest received another soft blow from Master Mahasya. The pandemonium of the world burst upon my unwilling ears. I staggered as though harshly awakened from a gossamer dream. The transcendent wine removed from my reach. "Little sir, I see you found the second bioscope to your liking." The saint was smiling. I started to drop in gratitude on the ground before him. "You can't do that to me now. You know God is in your temple also. I won't let Divine Mother touch my feet through your hands." If anyone observed the unpretentious master and myself as we walked away from the crowded pavement, the onlooker surely suspected us of intoxication. I felt the falling shades of evening were sympathetically drunk with God. When darkness recovered from its nightly swoon, I faced the new morning bereft of my ecstatic mood. But ever enshrined in memory is the seraphic son of Divine Mother, Master Mahasya. Trying with poor words to do justice to his benignity, I wonder if Master Mahasya and others, among the deep-visioned saints whose paths crossed mine, knew years later in a Western land, I would be writing about their lives as divine devotees. Their foreknowledge would not surprise me. I hope my readers, who have come thus far with me, would not be surprised either. Master's beautiful description here of this ecstatic experience. Yesterday we learned some new techniques for clearing energy channels. We have entered into what in Indian astrology is called the Dwapara Yuga, the electrical age. And truly we are all the recipients of this kind of electricity that runs through wires and operates computers and lights and air conditioning and heating and all the other kinds of comforts and technologies that we have today. It's enabled automobiles and airplanes and jet airplanes and even trips to the moon. It's been a fascinating era since 1899 when we officially entered fully into this Dwapara Yuga. And 200 years before that was the cusp period. And we saw there the discovery of electricity and its gradual use, but such a tremendous acceleration since that time. And these are marvels indeed, and they have helped us to live easier lives. What we have yet to discover as a culture is the electricity of the body. So much of medical science and physical science is focused on electricity that's found within the wires that can be transferred in this way. But we all know, even as children, that we're electrical beings. We can rub our feet on the ground with our socks on and walk up to another person and give them a shock. Or if we go near something that's metal, we can actually see a little electric arc go from the person to the piece of metal. You can take a balloon and you can rub it on your hair and then hold the balloon aloft and your hair will follow it, standing out straight. And in this way, we know that we have electricity throughout our being. In medical science, they use EKGs and EEGs in order to measure the heart rate, in order to measure brain activity. But not much else has really been explored or discovered around this body electric. This body electric is really a fascinating area of study. 5,000 years ago, at least, the yogis of ancient India were studying this body electric. They realized that the key to health was the proper flow of electricity. In China also, either borrowing ideas from one another or independently discovering it for themselves, the Chinese and the Indians both brought this science that from India and from China we have gained some little bit of knowledge in terms of medical health. And so we have acupuncture, and now we are learning about tapping the meridians. And in order to free the energy and to free us from emotional, psychological, and physical trauma and hurts and disruptions, this is really just the beginning. It is of such a profound nature that it really should be headline news, but it's not there yet. We're not there as a culture. We're not there as a society. Our thoughts have not caught up with it. But these yogis went so much further. They went into the divine nature about life. They learned that if they still the senses, where this electricity normally takes us through to the five senses, and we know that if we touch something, there's a small electrical current that's sent through the nerves to the brain. And there the brain interprets those electrical messages and registers as a touch. Something is soft, something is hard, something is warm or hot, as something else is cool or cold. Through our eyes, we have tiny little photons of light that hit the nerves there, and those nerves are then activated and they send a small electrical impulse to the brain. And it goes to a part of the brain that can interpret that impulse as a visual image if our eyes and brain are operating correctly. And so we learn a fascinating science, a physical science about how the nerves work. But these yogis went further. They began to experiment with withdrawing the life force that normally goes out through the five senses and preoccupies most of us, and learn to make that an inward process. They found through concentration and meditation that they were able to withdraw the life force from the five senses and into the spine, and then from the spine to rise up through different spinal centers. We talk about going up into heaven. And why do we call it up? It is because we go up the spine and these different centers. And as we do so, each center within the spine represents a different aspect of consciousness. One has to do with the body functioning and survival. Another with pleasure and with sexual reproduction. Another with individual will and willpower. And then another with the heart and with love and with compassion. And with an expansion for the first time as we go up through these centers, as going beyond our own selves, when we meet somebody that we fall in love with, or we have a child, or somebody that we love deeply, suddenly we realize we're willing to do something for them that is not in our own self-interest, perhaps. We're willing to give, we're willing to do, we're willing to go places and do things because that little one or that beloved needs us. And we willingly and gladly sacrifice ourselves in this way. And so this is the opening of the heart center, and it's the mediator between the human and the divine, because for the first time we transcend our own personal self-interest. And then we rise up to the level of speech and the power of words and truth, truth in the form of Dharma, the correct thing to do, what is the right thing to do, and knowledge and insight into those things that help us in our evolutionary course and those things that distract us. And back and forth we go, because each one of these centers has a polarity that has a positive and a negative draw. It has an up and a down to it. There is a story in the Mahabharata of Yudhishthira. And Yudhishthira is the eldest of the Pandavas. And for many years, I've wondered about a story about Yudhishthira, because he is a man of Dharma. He represents that fifth chakra at the throat center. And so he has that discrimination. But he gets enticed into a game, a gambling game. And he's attracted to gambling. And through that game, which is rigged from the very start, he loses his kingdom. He loses into slavery, his brothers, his wife, himself, everything that he has, he loses. And I wondered, how is it that this man of Dharma gets pulled into this game? Why doesn't his discrimination serve him there? And the answer finally came recently to me, as God is giving me answers when it's His sweet will to do so. And what I was shown was that the negative side of this fifth chakra is our ability to discern things, but we begin to play fast and loose with it. Everything has an inertia. It's difficult to get things going. It's difficult to make things change their course. And this is inertia, because things take on a certain course and they like to keep going in that way. When we get our life on track and we start to make good decisions, there's a certain inertia that takes over there, and it helps support us. In the same way that when we try to change a bad habit, that bad habit has an inertia and keeps us going in a direction that's not good for us. And we can even know it's not good for us, and we continue it anyway. And so this inertia takes over. Well, when we're on the positive path, we can make some decisions that we know is a little off, perhaps, a little risky, but we seem to get away with it. Because we are feeling the divine presence, we are having peace, we are having joy, we are having light in our lives, and if we make some small mistakes here and there, we seem to glide right on past it and we don't pay a price, and we can start to gamble with our experience. We quit paying attention in the same way that we had to when the inertia was running towards a bad habit and we had to work really hard to overcome that habit. And that sense of gambling, that sense of becoming reckless, took Yudhishthira over, and as a result, he got completely taken over by darkness. And this is what happens to many souls who even rise up high in consciousness. They seem to be doing all right. They're making good spiritual progress. They start to make decisions that are really not in accordance with what will serve them best. And they seem to get away with it, so they can even think that this is God's will. I have gone through this, so I know. And then it begins to catch up with you. And you realize that you can't make those kinds of decisions, because suddenly you're taken over by darkness, where before you had been filled with that light. And now you have to really fight in order to get back, because now the inertia is going with the negative habit that you yourself have cultivated. And so you get back on track again. You see, there is no God in heaven that is punishing us, really. It is just simply the law of cause and effect. And what we do, what we project from ourselves, comes back to us. If we project light, if we project love, if we project kindness, then we become the recipients of that, not even necessarily because the world gives us it in kind, but because we open ourselves up to that spirit, we get it from within. We feel love in greater measure. As you give, so shall you receive. When you give love, when you give compassion, when you give kindness, you receive it, not necessarily from this world, because we know that that doesn't always happen. Sometimes you give kindness and you get a slap in response. And of course, we don't like it when that happens. But if we continue as a giver, we don't withdraw from giving. We continue to give. Then we receive. We receive from Spirit. We receive from God. And we receive whatever it is that we give. You know, people who sow seeds of bitterness. They're bitter about life. They're angry about life. They don't like how life has treated them. And they're willing to tell anybody and everybody about it. And so they spread that. And then they find more reason in order to feel bitterness. And so it goes, and they build quite a field around them. And everything in their lives seems to confirm what they think already. They don't see goodness because they don't experience it. They don't experience it because they don't give it. They're waiting for the world to give them first. And then they think about giving, but that's not what the principle says. The principle says, as you give, so shall you receive. Not as you receive, so shall you give. And this is a very important distinction. And you ask yourself, if I don't have anything to give, then how can I give? But everybody has something to give. You give a little more patience. You give a little bit more love. You give a little bit more kindness, even if you're not feeling it. You do something in order to get that flow going. And as you give it, you get a little in return. If you have a relationship in your life that's unsatisfactory, then start giving what it is that you most want. I think Carla had a most marvelous idea at a time when she was single, and she was thinking about who she would like to attract in her life, and she made up a list of all the different virtues that she would like to have in a partner. And she did a marvelous thing then. She used that list to start to become all those things that she wanted to find in another person. Isn't that wonderful? Now, I don't know if she eventually found that person to be in her life that she wanted with all those virtues. You can ask her about that. But she cultivated those virtues in herself. And as you do so and you start giving them away, then the law of cause and effect will say you will draw more people into your life that will have those kinds of qualities to them. And if you find yourself withholding from this world because you're dissatisfied with it, or withholding from a relationship because you're dissatisfied with it, then you yourself become the poor, you see. It's a very basic principle, but it's difficult to enact, because when we get somebody who doesn't give us exactly what we're wanting, it's frustrating, it can produce anger, it can produce all kinds of reactions inside of us. But most of us will start to withhold from the other person. In sitting with Swami Satchitananda, time after time, I would see different family members coming in, and they would talk about family problems. Family problems in India are much the same as they are anyplace else. And sometimes they were very sticky ones. There was alcoholism, there was abuse, there's other kinds of things. And almost without exception, he would direct them towards serving their spouse, serving their family members. Now, you can think that this is producing the idea that you're a doormat, but it's not really so. Not when you really feel that God is serving you in the other person. You see, that changes it. That transforms it. Because now you are a receiver, and God will take care of the situation when your mind is focused on Him. And if it's really a bad situation, God will get you out of it. But you keep your mind on Him, you see. You give as God would give to this world. You see the world as God sees this world. You cultivate that. You think about it. You put yourself in that situation. And if you do that, it will change your life. No guarantees about the other person, but your life will change. Now, there's a wonderful chapter in this little book that we've offered, the Srimad Bhagavatam. And this is a book that Swami Satchidananda translated, much of it. Some of it he put together. They're his favorite stories. And this is Maya and how to transcend it. And the question comes, how do you transcend this Maya? So let me find my place here. And it starts this, after listening carefully what Yogi Hari said regarding the characteristics of a devotee of the Lord, King Nimi expressed his wish to know the true nature of Maya, i.e. the deluding potency of the Supreme Lord Vishnu, which bewilders even those who are adepts in conjuring tricks. Hearing this request, Yogi Atariksha said, Maya is that energy which the most ancient person, who is the source of the entire creation, evolved all forms of life, great and small, just for the enjoyment and emancipation of embodied souls, who are none but his own particles. For the good of jivas, that is, souls, having thus entered as the inner controller of all forms of life, evolved by means of five gross elements, the Supreme Person splits himself up. He appears first as one in the form of the mind, and then as ten in the form of the ten senses, and makes the jivas enjoy the various pleasures through them. Now, ten senses are mentioned here because you have five senses, and they classify them the same. But they're distinguishing here between the nerves that bring the sense impulse to the brain, and then that part of the brain which registers that sense enjoyment. So they term them as ten. And that's the ten qualities of the mind. Enjoying the various pleasures by means of the senses illuminated by him, the embodied soul identifies himself with this created body and gets attached to it. Performing with the organs of action, actions prompted by self-interest motive, and reaping the agreeable and disagreeable consequences of his varied actions of past lives, the embodied soul revolves in a whirlpool of mundane life, thus undergoing various forms of existence brought by his past actions and carrying many evils with them. The soul helplessly goes through repeated births and deaths until the dissolution of creation. When the dissolution is nearing, the time spirit, Kala, which is without beginning and end, actually draws the manifested universe, consisting of all the gross and subtle matters, towards the unmanifest, primordial matter. During this process, there appears on the earth a dreadful drought lasting for 100 years. The sun, with its heat increased, torments the three worlds. Then the host of clouds, charged with universal dissolution, pours down showers as thick as the trunk of an elephant for 100 years, nonstop, with the result that the cosmos will be merged in water. Then, leaving his cosmic body, Brahma merges into Brahman. Brahma is God the Father as the creator. Brahman is God the Father as unmanifest, without creation, without form. Just as the fire enters into the unmanifest state, i.e. extinguished when divested of fuel. Denuded of its smell by the wind, the earth is converted into a state of water. And deprived of its taste, water is reduced to a state of fire. Deprived of its color by darkness, fire gets merged into air. Deprived of its quality of touch by ether, the air merges into ether, its cause. Ether is then deprived of its quality of sound by God in the form of the time spirit, and made to merge into the tamasic ego. The senses and the intellect merge into the ego of passion. The mind with the deities born of the illumined ego merges into the knowledge of self. The ego with its triple modifications merges into Mahatattva, which in turn merges into Prakriti. Prakriti ultimately merges into Brahman. We have just described to you the Lord's triple Maya comprising of Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, which creates, sustains, and annihilates this creation. Now this is actually not describing something that happens in the world. It's really describing what happens within your own being deep in meditation. This is what I have shown as I read this. And so we start out with 100 years of intensity of the sun shining. And this happens when the kundalini is awakened inside of you, and it causes what is called here a drought. Because that fire goes in and it begins to dissipate everything that was a draw towards this world. And it dries you up in that sense, and it is a difficult time when that kundalini is burning brightly inside of you. And it lasts for 100 years, or the 10 senses times 10. So you're going through this, and it goes through every aspect and multiple of the 5 senses. Of 5 times 2, which is the 10, and that's squared. And so that equals going through every aspect, every possible combination of the senses, and it dries it up. And then you are deluged by that which will bring about the total destruction. The deluge that comes to you in the size of an elephant trunk is the living waters of spirit. It is the baptism. And it washes you clean. It washes through you. And it also lasts for 100 years because it's going and purifying all the senses. It's already been purified through the kundalini, but now it's being saturated. And so you're filled with the bliss, and you're filled with this purifying spirit that's coming to you through this deluge. And sometimes it's overwhelming because it's coming in such terrific torrents. But it's all going for your higher good. And then comes the rolling up of the senses. The leaving of the cosmic body, Brahma merges into unmanifest Brahman, just as the fire enters into the unmanifest state. So now what follows is how that happens. And first, the is denuded of smell by the wind. So smell is the first sense that begins to withdraw itself back into the primordial source when you're meditating. And then the earth is converted into a state of water and deprived of its taste. And so taste then is withdrawn from the tongue and from the mouth as you enter into this deeper state. And sometimes, most times when you enter into this higher state, your tongue will swell, you know, become the size almost of your entire mouth. Or there are times when the tongue will automatically curl and bring itself back up into the nasal passage. And so you are cutting yourself off from the sense of taste. And then water is reduced to a state of fire. Deprived of its color by darkness, fire gets merged into air. So even your interior vision that you have during meditation, you may have different visions, sights, that kind of thing. That then, too, gets withdrawn into the primordial source, into Brahman. Deprived of its quality of touch by ether, the air merges into ether, its cause. And so ether is then deprived of its quality of sound, which is the last thing to go. As we're sitting and meditating, oftentimes we're distracted by various sounds that come to us. But eventually, even sound is withdrawn into the interior primordial source from which you have evolved. And when that happens, you're then made to merge into tamasic ego. Now, this is not tamasic ego as we normally think of it. This is the universal tamasic ego, which is all your senses and everything is at rest. And so that is the state of disillusion that you come into, in that sense of the tamasic ego. The senses and the intellect merge into the ego of passion. Passion, in this case, is that urge to express itself out as life and all of life. And now that is withdrawn into that primordial source. The mind with the deities born of illuminated ego merges into the knowledge of the self with the capital S. Now the deities are the same as those angels. They are your higher nature. Those are your higher thoughts. And so even thoughts of a divine nature, even thoughts as a higher nature, those too become withdrawn. Now this is a process that we go through. And so what Master was describing in the autobiography of a yogi was that his senses were withdrawn. He could still see, but he couldn't hear. And he was in that state of stillness. But so he had partially withdrawn, but he had not fully withdrawn. And that wasn't to come for quite some time. Because this is for most of us, this is a long process. The ego with its triple modifications merges into Mahatattva, in which in turn merges into Prakriti. Now Prakriti is the originator of all creation. And so now Prakriti, that original design for all creation, is being withdrawn. These are very subtle states that are being described here. And so this primordial kind of design that always exists really in spirit, but it retires into a state of stillness. It's all rolling up. It's all being withdrawn into the highest center, up into your Sahasrara. That is the crown chakra at the top of your head. That is what Brahman represents. And so Prakriti ultimately merges into Brahman. We have described to you the Lord's triple Maya comprising of Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, which creates, sustains, and annihilates creation. When this happens, you are completely drawn up into the unexpressible divine spirit. It is completely still, and yet it is filled with all the potency that is expresses itself as all creation, which also is part of all of this universe. It's what expresses itself as this universe. So you can imagine that the power of that went into creation of this universe, the intelligence that went into it, all of that is contained within still spirit, within that Brahman, formless, beginningless, endless spirit. So you're not missing anything. People in their human sense can try to project into this, and sometimes they think, well, wouldn't that be boring? You wouldn't have any form, you wouldn't have any anything going on, any action. And it's true. Not action as we normally think it, but all action is contained within that still state. Even as you think of a body of water, a lake, for instance, that is being held back by a dam. And that lake becomes completely still when there's no wind whatsoever. And it reflects all the stars, the sun, the moon, everything. But when that water is released through the spillway of the dam, it makes a tremendous noise. You see the cascading waters. Perhaps it goes down and it turns some turbines, which produces power and electricity. Lots of things happen. But then you look on the other side of the dam and you just see complete, still, quiet. But all of that energy is being held in potential. And when you retire into the Sahasrara, the crown chakra of the head, you are everything that creation is in potential. But you are quiet. You are still. You drink deep of those deep waters. You don't feel that there's anything, any need to express yourself because everything is contained within you. But if divine will wills it, then you naturally spill over the spillway and you are a part of creation once again. At one point in Mother's experiences, she was lifted high up above this earth in consciousness. And she looked down upon this earth and she knew that she had gone through all the experiences that she needed to in order to completely free herself. She had no individual karma. She's actually not born with any individual karma. But she had no individual karma. There's nothing for her left to do from a human standpoint. She had achieved it all. But she looked down upon this world and she felt compassion for those who are struggling in darkness, for those who wanted the divine experience. And even if they were walking with faltering steps, her compassion and her heart went out to all of us. And she thought, I want to serve, you see. So in that still state, she was that reservoir of water, but then she came back down into the world and she started to express herself again. But it wasn't easy for her at first because she is so drawn up into that highest experience. It was so seductive, it was so alluring that she didn't want to leave it. It was like Master describing when Master Mahasya touched him over the heart again and suddenly all this sound came crashing in on him and it was overwhelming. You want to stay in that still state. The lovely devotee who, during childbirth, she had what is called a near-death experience. She died for a short amount of time, giving birth to her daughter. And where she was at was so beautiful, so enticing. She didn't want to leave it, not at all. But then she thought of her children and their need for her, and that she was the sole support for them at that point. And she knew that she needed to come back. It was her heart of compassion. But she's never really fully settled herself on being in this life because she's known what is beyond. When people leave this body, we oftentimes grieve for them. But if we grieve for anything, we should grieve for ourselves because we're left behind in a sense. But we don't have to die in the body in order to enter into that death-like state. St. Paul said, Behold, I die daily in my Christ. In Christ's consciousness, he had learned to master himself, withdraw all his life energy from the senses and up the spine into the higher regions of the brain. And as a result of that, he could die daily, consciously. But he could also be reborn and resurrect himself. And he could enter back in and serve some more. And so this is what a true spiritual master can do. This Dwapara Yuga will yield many of these truths. Society at large will become interested, not right away, but it's coming. It's coming. And one day these will be headline news as if that never existed before. And yet, it's been all around us. It's been there. It's just a matter of people's interest, you see. So we can stand at a vanguard. We can stand at the head of the line, helping to guide others into that self-same experience, if we choose to. If we listen to that inner call, we learn how to become masters of ourself. We learn how to withdraw this life energy. Now, this ego nature has an inertia to it. No mistaking about that. This is not a small goal. It's the biggest, most terrific task that a human being has. But it's also the most rewarding. And if we apply ourselves and do it with sincerity and do it with earnest and doing it with consistency, and never letting up, always bending ourselves towards that goal, we will achieve success. This is what is promised to us. And depending on our efforts, depending on our sincerity, depending on what we do, how we live our lives from day to day, that will determine the level of our success. Whatever level we attain, we carry with us into the next life, if we are to have more lives. And so eventual success is guaranteed. But why not make it this lifetime? Why deny ourselves freedom, even for another minute? Let us strive to enter more deeply into that stillness. Yes, there are challenges to doing this, but we have been given some powerful tools. We should not leave them on the shelf gathering dust, but we should apply them and learn to go deep, more deeply. Every week, have at least one period of meditation where you extend it, double your time. Go further, go deeper, because time allows you to move down through the different layers. We could do it if we had the purity of mind to do it in a minute. But most of us are developing that purity of mind. So it takes time. It takes effort. It takes diligence. But it is a great science, and if we will apply it, we will get the results. So this is a wonderful opportunity for us all. And not to miss out on that opportunity, not to let this life go by and then that day comes when you leave the body and you think to yourself, oh my goodness, I got so caught up with this world and all the things of this world, I forgot again. I missed the opportunity. There are things that you can do here in this material existence that you cannot do elsewhere. So this is the place to do this. And you will never regret it. You will never look back on your life and say, oh, I made too much spiritual effort. That won't be the regret. There will be regrets, but it won't be that. So let us apply ourselves. Be good spiritual scientists. And learn to dive deep and to find our freedom in spirit. This is that great electrical age. The world doesn't necessarily support you in this. So don't look to the world to support you. If you get some support, great. But otherwise, forge forward. Pioneers are never supported. That's what makes them pioneers. And so stretch out and experience the divine consciousness, the bliss, the joy, the light of God. It's all waiting for you. It's right inside of you. That great body of water, it's right with you even right now, if you would but open yourself to it. Please pray with me. Oh, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging through every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. To the light within you.